now with over 25 years of experience integrating mental health and spirituality, the author of Reclaiming Authenticity, When Ancestors Weep, and Redeeming the Bereaved. Here is Dr. James Houck.
Right. Good evening. Good evening. Good evening, everybody, wherever you are in the world at this time. Welcome to Reclaiming Authenticity, finding one's courage to reclaim that which you have always been and that which has always been in you. Very excited to be with you here tonight and every other Wednesday night at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 6 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. I'm Dr. James Houck, and if you would like more information about me, or maybe you want to leave me your comments about tonight's show, I just invite you to visit that website. It's www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity. It's www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity. And just in case you cannot spend the entire hour with me tonight, these broadcasts are podcasts also, in case you want to go back and listen again, or in case you want to go back into the archives and listen to previous shows that you might have missed. So again, just go back into the website and click on archives, and you can just pull up any show date that and title that grabs your attention, let's say. Yeah. And if you're going to spend the whole hour with me tonight, that would be wonderful. And if you'd like to call in and be part of tonight's show, I invite you to call the toll-free line. It's 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. And give me your insights. Give me your comments. Give me your thoughts all on tonight's subject. All tied up inside, untying the knots of our ignorance. Well, now in my fifth year with BBS Radio, these broadcasts have always, from day one, always focused on the continued integration of our spirituality and our mental health, all within the context of our relationships with ourselves, with others, and God or the divine. And this is an essential integration of our spirituality and our mental health, because quite often our minds interpret what we take in through our senses. Okay, it just happens to everybody. We take in information through our senses, and based on our previous experiences, or let's say education levels, or our upbringing, or so forth, you know, our mind's interpretation often fails to capture a more accurate understanding of the deeper lessons out there for us, or greater realities, or even greater truths, because our egos, which are very self-centered and limited, our egos come in, oftentimes very subtle, but very, very fast. And they come in, they take over, and they keep us from knowing ourselves as that vast and eternal soul. And as well as, how then do we live that out? How then do we live in this world with all of us issues and problems and joys and celebrations? How do we live out being a soul in forgiveness, gratitude, bliss, and love on a day in, day out basis? Well, admittedly, it is our egos that often lead us astray with all kinds of thoughts and selfish pursuits, a kind of a lower level consciousness, if you will, which is always going to be bound by time and space and causation. And yet, how often are we guilty of not paying attention to our egos and our mind's distorted templates for teaching us something more about ourselves and showing us where our healing and transformation are still needed? For example, okay, there's a huge difference between, let's say, worldly love, which is, you know, the more familiar to us, and godly or divine love. Now, according to my teacher and dear friend, we often use the term, I love you, But such love is conditional because it's temporary and it changes as it goes back and forth of conflicting emotions of the mind, such as, let's say, envy or jealousy or even hatred. Right? But godly or divine love is a love that's not entangled in the human emotions of the mind. You know, divine love is eternal and it's not conditional. It actually helps others to purify their minds by recognizing only that which is divine in all. And this is, in a sense, what reclaiming authenticity is all about, because it can be summed up in one word, namaste, which roughly translated means, because I see myself as a soul of light. This allows me to greet your lighted soul of who you truly are, even if you don't see it in yourself. Well, this integration of spirituality and our mental health begins here, because when we examine and implement this integration, we are going to come face to face with our deepest physical, emotional, psychological, and even spiritual woundedness that we have experienced in and through relationships. And in addition, this is also where we're going to come face to face with our ego and believe that we're going to find that happiness and joy and contentment, only to discover that the larger the ego becomes, the greater the sorrows are sown in our lives. Because you see, eventually our egos bring us back to coming to terms with the relationships in our lives. It could be families, it could be coworkers, it could be friends, it could be other relationships. But godly or divine love brings about healing and transforms our woundedness into something more life-giving, more tangible, and definitely eternal. And this transformation is needed especially with people whom society says are unlovable or unreachable or untouchable. But when we do the work of integrating healthier ways of suppressing this ego through embracing, you know, our as well as their value, dignity, and worth as a soul, not only are we transformed, but we're also going to transform others by our presence and just how we act around people, just even if we don't say anything, just how we are. And we're also going to transform others, you know, through those grace-filled moments and those moments of understanding, because we have learned and we are learning to walk in forgiveness, gratitude, and love. Or maybe, you know, just put it another way, you know, I love the Dutch priest and professor Henry Nouwen, as he puts it. He says, just by paying attention to what's going on around us, we discover that there are people who heal each other's wounds and forgive one another's offenses. They share their possessions and they foster the spirit of community. They celebrate the gifts that they have received and live in constant anticipation of the full manifestation of God's glory. Well, as I begin every broadcast, I begin with a question. What's your heart today? I hope your heart is well. I hope you are well, and I hope that even if you are struggling in some capacity today, that you'll be able to find rest, that you'll be able to find comfort, you'll be able to find that peace that you need. All right. Well, all of that, what I've said, is just the warm-up. And speaking of up, if you're like me, you're always up for a good laugh or funny stories, let's say. And regarding tonight's topic of being inwardly all tied up in knots, I came across a blog, just a funny, funny blog that pointed out the meanings and uses of the word. And I think it was on Neowin website, Neowin website. And this particular blogger writes, there's a two-letter word that perhaps has more meaning than any other two-letter word. And that is up. Now, if you're if you're not confused after reading this, then you must really be messed up. Because when we wake in the morning, why is it that we wake up? And at a meeting, why does a topic always seem to come up? And why do we speak up? And why are the officers up for re-election or election? And why is it to the secretary to write up a report? I mean, we call up our friends and we use it to, to even brighten up a room and polish up the silver. We warm up the leftovers and clean up the kitchen. We lock up the house and, let's say some guys and women too will spend their weekends fixing up an old car. And at other times, this little word has a real special meaning, such as people stir up trouble. We line up for tickets. We work up an appetite. We think up excuses. And to be dressed is one thing, but to be dressed up is very special. And this is where it gets really confusing. A drain must be opened up because it is stopped. We open up a store in the morning, but we close it up at night. And we seem to be pretty mixed up about. And if you're up to it, you might try building up a list of many ways up is used. It will take up a lot of your time, but if you don't give up, you may wind up with 100 or more. So whenever it threatens to rain, we say it's clouding up. And when the sun comes out, we say it's clearing up. When it rains, it wets up the earth. And when it doesn't rain for a while, we say things are drying up. And one could go on and on and on, but I'll wrap it up for now because my time is up. So I will sit down and, let's say, shut up. Oh, and one last thing. When we pass on, we hope to go. Well, like I said, it's very clever indeed. So many thanks to the NeoWind website and the blogger who put this together. And despite the very funny ways in which we use the word up in our vocabulary, admittedly, there are times when we feel all tied up inside. Okay, at least that's how many of my clients describe themselves when dealing with anxiety and or trauma. Well, if you've ever seen the movie What About Bob? It's hilarious. One of the more memorable scenes is when Dr. Marvin, the psychiatrist played by Richard Dreyfuss, that he's had enough of his patient Bob Wiley, who was played by Bill Murray. I mean, it's just comedic genius putting these two actors together. And Bob Wiley, follows Dr. Marvin on his vacation with his family. He just shows up and everything's good. And like, what's the problem? I'm here. And the family, loves him and has a great time. But Dr. Marvin is not. Okay. And so when he could no longer take the day in and day out antics of Bob, Dr. Marvin leads Bob out into the woods one night and he ties him to a chair, all rigged with a timer and bombs. And he tells Bob that this therapy is called death therapy, which of course is not a real thing. But however, as time is ticking away, Bob has this light bulb moment that when he realized that just as he must untie the knots in the rope that have him bound to this chair of bombs, so too he must unite, or I should say untie, the mental or emotional knots that keep him bound to his stinking thinking, lest he implodes. It's a great scene. Okay, so if you haven't seen it, definitely. And really, it's not a bad way to get across a deeper message of how often we live our lives in chains, so to speak, but we never know that we have the key, figuratively speaking. Well, one of the things I run into the most, still to this day, when counseling others, is the need to let go of a former concept or even a philosophy or an expectation or an assumption that no longer serves them. And a lot of we have different ways in which we can describe this. We call it stinking thinking, okay, or cognitive distortions, okay? But a lot of times what we think is real is not always the case, okay? So stinking thinking is a term that often comes up in 12-step programs to refer to the negative patterns of thought that add fuel to the fire, let's say, of people's recovery process. See, it's one thing to stop drinking. It's one thing to stop using drugs or stop gambling and so forth. But you also have to unlearn the cognitive distortions, the messages that people tell themselves or try to justify their gambling or their drug use or whatever. You have to let those go, and you have to replace them with more positive patterns of thought. Okay. So these thoughts, you know, the stinking thinking thoughts, sabotage our ability to see the world clearly and take responsibility for our actions. And a lot of the time, this process of healing involves an awareness of these inaccurate but very personal beliefs that no longer serve us in healthy ways, such as, let's say, whenever we walk into a room, you know, and we hear a bunch of people talking and laughing, but the minute they see us, everything is quiet, except for a few crickets that we hear in the corner. And we might wrongly assume that everybody was talking about us or making fun of us, or maybe we did something wrong. Or another example, let's say that you get a 6-month or a yearly evaluation. And your supervisor slash boss will say something like this: "Tiffany, you're a great employee. You're on time. You do quality work. In fact, I wish I had 10 more employees like you. However, there's just one little area we would like to see you improve in." And Tiffany comes away from this evaluation thinking that she's the worst employee there ever was, because all she can focus on is that one little area that was criticized, and totally diverts her attention away from all the outstanding areas in her work. Well, have you ever had knots in your shoelaces, or, you know, power cords, you know, knots in your power cord, or your phone or an iPad ever get knotted up and you just have to detangle them, you know, from like the charging cord? Well, these distortions are like knots in a cloth, let's say, that need to be dissolved. And at any rate, we often believe, or I should say, we often believe that what we see and hear is all that there is to see and hear. But this is simply not the case. Because in order for us to see things as they truly are, we need to dissolve these delusions of the mind, you know, to get rid of these knots, especially when it comes to understanding and embracing ourselves and others as living souls. Well, one of my favorite teachings of my from my teacher in India is when he once shared a lesson involving the Vedanta concept of laya, which means to dissolve, you know, especially to dissolve the delusions of the mind and our perceptions of our experiences. And he stated one time that the mind interprets what it sees, and it interprets what it hears and tastes and touches and smells as truth. But these sense experiences can in no way reveal the truth of our existence. So let's think about it this way. Suppose we walk by a demolition site where workers are dismantling a house. And so once the house has been demolished, let's say there's just lots and lots of bricks left over. And let's take it one step further, that let's just say these workers dismantle even the bricks. And now we are left with, say, clay, or the original state of the house's existence. Say it's just made out of bricks, which is really made out of clay and so forth. Now, to the mind, the house and the bricks have been dismantled And there are no longer objects to be seen or held or heard or whatever, because they all have returned to their basic substance. That is, clay. Okay? And all things have this capability to be understood as once having existed in their, let's say, original substance. And yet the key in dissolving this delusion of our minds, this falsehood of what we think we can see and hear and feel and taste and smell as real, is to first recognize an object's original state or substance. So, as we look at others and we engage with others, are we able to see them and engage with them as a soul? Or are we so consumed with the externals? Well, there's a Taoist principle of Hu, which is the exact opposite of up, but it's he hyphen you. It's huh, like you're blowing a feather, you know, huh. That's often understood in the book, The Adventures of Winnie the Pooh. Great book, great book. If you haven't read it in a while, check it out of the library or download it. You know, it's great, okay? A lot of, let's say, life's lessons through Winnie the Pooh. And this principle of huh is translated as the image of the uncarved block, which means that the things in their original state carry their own natural energy. Okay, so another example that whenever you manipulate that thing or you carve the block, you may tend to think that, well, now it's lost its power. But in these stories, Pooh Bear, okay, is the embodiment of the uncarved block. You know, he's Pooh Bear because he is simple-minded. And he doesn't think too much about what life means or how to change the world to suit his desires. He just simply exists in the world, and he takes life for what it is. And yes, okay, once we carve or we cut the wood, we can make all kinds of beautiful items from it. Tables, bed frames, coffee tables, dressers, wardrobes, so on and so forth. And for all of that beauty and more, all of these items have one thing in common. They all come from wood. Well, let's bring this idea of understanding or seeing things in their original substance into the world of humanity, okay? Let's say that we, at our base substance or our base existence, is that we are souls, okay? We're not the bodies that we see when we look in the mirror. And yes, we can see ourselves when we look into the mirror, okay? But that's not really who we are when you get right down to it. And yes, we have a body that needs to be cared for and fed and rested and given medicines when it gets sick or diseased. But we are truly souls at the end of the day. And you know, what a difference it would make in the world, in this world in which we live right now, if we all interacted with one another as divine souls with the capacity of recognizing divine love. Well, unfortunately, we see just the opposite. I mean, all we have to do is just turn on the news, and there it is. You know, we tend to focus on the externals. We might focus on a person's skin color, or their gender, or their age, or their height, or their weight, or their socioeconomic status, or whatever it is. But it's external. And all of these externals have created these isms in our lives, you know, such as ageism or sexism, genderism, you know, whatever it is, you know, and so forth. But when we can dissolve this illusion of the mind, we begin to understand one another in a whole new way. And many theologians and scholars and scientists down through the centuries have often struggled to come up with the most accurate definition of what the soul is, let alone what is our relationship to ourselves. And therefore, without trying to muddy the scholastic waters, here's my definition of what the soul is. It is the purest essence of ourselves that exceeds all physical, emotional, psychological limitations. Strip everything else away in our lives, and it is our soul that is a divine mirror of the soul, the universe. And it is this soul whom God sees when God looks at us. Or as God puts it, before you were born, I knew you. Now, we have no idea what that looks like. But we do know that before we were born, we were formless, and our bodies gave us form. Now, the soul isn't just something we have as a result of being creative, you know. Instead, the soul is who we authentically are. We're not merely bodies that have souls, it's just the opposite. We are divine souls who have bodies. And in a sense, our mind and body provide the form, you know, the breath, the matter, the movement to our soul, which is formless. And yet we may still believe that there's nothing more to us than, say, our mind or our body, you know, all the externals out there. I mean, after all, our physical nature strongly contends for our attention all the time in terms of hunger and thirst and fatigue and pain and sickness and procreation and so on and so on and so on. And ironically, we may often misunderstand an all-important lesson as we try to drown out the soul's cry for that divine connection by focusing instead on what our egos and minds are projecting in any given moment. But nonetheless, it is the cry of the soul in each of us. Fully realize that we are primarily souls, and we long to have that connection and reconnection with God. You know, and this is a point that I, you know, just fully appreciate from my India friends. You know, as I shared last broadcast, that we often get on the subject of sin and God and forgiveness and so forth, and you know, they say, well, our definition of sin is more ignorance, you know, that people don't realize that they are already in a relationship with God. They just don't understand that, and therefore they're going to act in ignorance. Okay. But you know, regardless of whether or not we have suffered trauma or paying attention to ourselves as souls and listening to our inner cry, this moves us out of the illusion that a mind-body consciousness rules us at the end of the day. You know, important as those things are, the mind and body are mainly vehicles to realize a higher consciousness of our soul. So when we listen attentively to our soul's cry, we become aware that everything we truly desire can never be reached by the mind and the body, because these are always driven by ego and selfishness and fear and pain and pleasure and so forth. And this is not to say that the mind and body, you know, are all evil and the soul is all good. You know, this kind of duality was what drove people in medieval times to punish themselves with physical wounds, you know, believing that they could suppress their ego and physical desires in order to become more righteous and holy in the eyes of others and God. But again, this is to misunderstand who we are as a soul and the concept and application, divine love. And we can never attain higher levels of God consciousness through the mind and the body because these forms are limited. Well, I would really love to hear what's on your heart about this subject. So again, if you'd like to call in, that number is 888-627-6008, and I'll be taking your calls after this break. Again, you are listening to Reclaiming Authenticity, and I'm your host, Dr. James Houck. Be back with you in 1 minute.
Thank you.
All right, everybody. I'm Dr. James Hauke, and you've been listening to Reclaiming Authenticity, where we have been discussing tonight the theme of all tied up inside, untying the knots of our ignorance. Well, whenever I was in graduate school, long time ago, I was first exposed to Abraham Maslow's hierarchy of needs as a means of understanding our human nature and striving to achieve personal goals. And this model of understanding, ourselves, follows the logic that our lives go through stages of attaining personal needs, such as food, clothing, and shelter, and security, intimacy with others, and goals, and life meaning, and purpose, and so forth. And ironically, many people today still believe that once they attain self-actualization, which is the goal of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, or discovering their life's purpose and motivation and meaning, that then they will have finally found their life satisfaction that has so long eluded them. And yet, many are often met with a very harsh reminder that in attaining one's dreams and ambitions and goals doesn't necessarily guarantee happiness, let alone finding this inner peace. Okay, and moreover, despite their accomplishments, which are wonderful and many, people still sense that something is missing in their lives. And if this is so, why then do so many people feel empty when they have so much? I mean, what's the problem? And perhaps these feelings of disappointment with Maslow's hierarchy stem from this misperception that it is a very good model. Rather, it's a flawed model. Perhaps we need to understand that this model itself is limited, because self-actualization carries us only so far. Because you see, attaining true happiness and joy and peace in our lives, something that everybody wants, doesn't come in the accumulation of things and degrees and accomplishments. Rather, these come from the grace of God's presence that can only touch our soul. Because indeed, there is a greater depth of contentment and forgiveness and love and joy and peace and so forth that awakens in us when we fully realize ourselves as souls. And it is through God's grace that we are able to recognize our soul's connection to God, and we throw off, let's say, this cloak of illusion, or we untie the knots. But still, the limitation of Maslow's model here, it doesn't mean that self-actualization is a worthless pursuit. Even on the contrary, we all need to have our basic physical needs met. We all need to have a sense of personal security. We all strive to have meaningful relationships and attain goals in our lives. And yet we also have to understand that these earthly pursuits are always pointing us towards a higher awakening of self-realization of who we truly are. Interestingly, we can learn this lesson as we become involved in healing intergenerational trauma, which is something I, take great care to lead people through, because everybody wants to know about their past. Everybody wants to know about their family trees and so on and so forth. And quite often you will come face to face again with, this intergenerational trauma somewhere, somehow, through somebody. Trauma comes down through the generations. It's not the only thing, but sooner or later, we're going to run into something traumatic. And yet, the first thing we need to do is to, step outside our linear thinking, let's say, of our past, present, and future, take a leap of faith, and fall into God's grace that opens us up to this expanded consciousness. Because once we realize who we are as a soul, I guarantee you, we are then going to be empowered to re-engage Maslow's hierarchy from a more, let's say, life-giving inspiration that focuses not on an ego-driven achievement, but rather that which enhances our value, our dignity, and worth in all relationships. So realized souls are no longer motivated to feed others just for the sake of alleviating their own guilt and filling empty stomachs, but rather their motivation would now come from the awareness that by feeding others, they're also feeding souls with compassion and grace. And instead of spending time with another family member or friend or whatever out of obligation, realized souls instead see another soul in need of friendship and love. And instead of forgiving others from the perspective of, well, what do I get out of it? We instead forgive because we're not going to allow people to carry the crippling effects of unforgiveness and bitterness and what that has done to them and us as souls. Because all in all, as we bless others in, let's say, a physical sense, we also bless them in a spiritual sense. In fact, when we meet even the basic needs of one another, these benevolent acts inevitably nudge others closer to discovering who they authentically are as a soul. So never diminish even the simplest acts of kindness or compassion and grace, for these are truly the acts that can touch the soul and guarantee you again that will cause all of heaven to rejoice, because even a cup of cold water can invoke this. So self-realization fulfills self-actualization. Well, I'm sure if you've been following this program, you've heard me say on more than one occasion, my all-time favorite books is The Alchemist. And if you have ever read The Alchemist, you realize that the young boy in the story, Santiago, he has this journey to the Egyptian pyramids to find his personal legend. And ironically, his journey has literally brought him back to the place where he left initially. But the main point of the story is that Santiago has been also on an inward journey, because he himself has been transformed along the way. All in all, he was clearly not the same person he was when he left at the beginning. So very similar, just like T.S. Eliot once said, "Let us not cease for exploration." And for all of our exploring will be for us to arrive at a place where we started and know it for the very first time. And a prominent theme that runs through the book, The Alchemist, is that through the character Santiago, we realize that when you really want something to happen, the whole universe will conspire so that your wish comes true. And it is this theme that actually ties us back into tonight's topic, because, you know, this is something that I truly believe in. That when we pay attention to what has been placed in our hearts and we hear the cry of our soul and we commit to it, the entire universe will make it happen if we remain open and teachable to every situation in our lives. Because when we do this, we also are going to discover that we may just have been destined to embrace the cry of our soul all along. Well, throughout history, this physical and chemical alchemy was and is concerned with altering and transforming the chemical properties within solid matter, such as, you know, the classic example is changing lead into gold. But spiritual alchemy is concerned with freeing your vast spiritual self, which would be hindered within you by all the unrefined parts of yourself, things such as your fears, or limited personal beliefs, or self-loathing, or whatever it is that's really getting in the way. In other words, it has tied itself up in knots. But Spiritual alchemy is vastly more multifaceted, and it's ongoing. We never stop with that. It's a continuous purification of our hearts, much like in the same way, a metalsmith is going to turn up the heat beneath a hopper that contains a raw mineral or a metal. And as this heat is increased, the dross or the impurities are going to come to the surface only to be skimmed off, making the metal purer than what it was before. And this process is repeated over and over again and again until the metal reaches its finest purity that it can be. Well, we too go through this process of a spiritual alchemy of authenticity. And how often does it feel like the heat is being turned up through on us through past and current events throughout the world? And therefore, whenever we go through this process of spiritual awakening, or we recognize that we're going through this process, sooner or later, we are, confronted with the fact that there seems to be so much more to ourselves than the reality we are living in and what we have grown accustomed to. There is so much more to ourselves. And as we go through life, and depending on our experiences in this life, we are going to start to question what used to be true for us. Okay, so here we go, dissolving the knots again. So, for example, ever since childhood, we have a certain way in which we see ourselves, or we have a certain way of interacting with others, and we even have a certain way of how we see God and interact with God in the world at large. And when we have gone through an experience, let's say, that really shakes us up or shatters our childhood assumptions, we're going to feel as though nothing makes sense anymore. That we don't really seem to have a sense of our bearings, let alone knowing which way is up. No pun intended. And this can be very unnerving, a very unnerving state or place that we find ourselves in, especially if we feel like all of that which we have ever known is starting to crumble. And it evaporates. We can't hold it together because it's slipping through our fingers, figuratively speaking. And we could become so unsure of not only ourselves, but also whether or not all that we see is all that there is. And yet, when we weather these storms, we're also going to discover that something greater than ourselves is tugging at our soul. We could call it a stronger nudge from God, or a more intense dimensional energy, or even a hunger that just resonates deep, deep, deep within us, like compelling us to go and search to discover the vastness of who we truly are. And as we go on this journey, we're going to discover that there are things we need to identify and let go of and transform in order to embrace higher, more intense spiritual dimension. So in other words, rising above those negative mental, emotional, physical, and even spiritual triggers that keep us from experiencing the fullness of unconditional love. And this phenomenon is at the heart of a multidimensional understanding of spirituality. Because you see, listening to the cries of our ancestors and listening to the cries of our souls compels us to heal relationship with them and to heal from how we have been wounded, as well as begin to act with all people on a soul level. And yet, is self-realization powerful enough to transform social systems that promote oppression, prejudice, control? Yeah, many people would say that the more we understand the history of humanity, transforming these systems is downright impossible. In fact, there are some who consider systems to be suspect in and of themselves, and therefore choose to work outside the system. Okay? And yet, there are also people who choose to remain within a system and work with individuals to create change. Well, whatever your preference is, we can say for certain that self-realization transforms people from an ego-driven consciousness now to a soul consciousness, which in turn has an impact on systems. Well, one day, a former student of mine reminded me of this potential effect by saying, I'd love this quote, that we ought never allow the coldness of an institution to discourage us from finding the warmth of individuals. Let me say that again, because this is worth remembering. We ought never allow the coldness of an institution, whatever that institution is, to discourage us from finding the warmth of individuals. And this is a very profound statement. Indeed, the more we embrace the fact that all persons are souls, the more awakened we are to change the world. And although we can understand this historical impact of governmental and educational and religious and other social systems, it is their dysfunctional interconnectedness that often reinforces the contemporary negative behaviors of oppression, prejudice, and abuses of power. But if we truly believe that we can create a lasting change, that we can be a lasting change in ourselves and others and the world, then we have to admit that transformation is difficult, not impossible. It's difficult to achieve within present dysfunctional systems that resist change. So let's say a dysfunctional system perpetuates intergenerational trauma because these typically distort the message of what they believe endows humanity with its values, dignity, and worth. And yet humanity's motivations and behaviors are inaccurately, let's say, assessed. Perhaps along the lines of productivity or consumerism, over and against placing value on a person as a soul. And unfortunately, if the dysfunction or the illusion is never addressed or healed or removed, then the ramifications of these very negative attitudes and behaviors are going to affect generation after generation after generation. And unfortunately, some present systems that we've been exposed to or we've been seeing all along, when, you know, some present systems have been broken and dysfunctional for many generations. And if they don't change, they're going to continue to deteriorate. And yet transformation is always possible because systems are made up of individuals. And indeed, their dysfunction in inter and intra-personal relationships will always come to light because their thoughts, their speech, their behavior rise out of their emotional, psychological, and or spiritual wounds. And moreover, such wounds hinder people from awakening to who they truly are and therefore remain unable to embrace their soul consciousness. And this inability is not a fault issue or a character flaw, but it just might be where they are on their life path, a path that can be liberated towards self-realization at any given moment. Well, throughout centuries, shame and guilt have often been used in society as a means to control people, you know, to shame somebody into feeling a certain way about themselves or to make people feel guilty in order to get them to do something. And unfortunately, society has, on more than one occasion, interchanged these words to convey its disappointment in others. So we often hear, you know, examples such as, you know, shame on you, or you ought to be ashamed of yourself. And immediately, we get this sense that something is wrong or somebody is disappointed. And with shame, people often internalize this message to mean, oh, there must be something wrong with me, or maybe I'm flawed in some way because I don't seem to measure up to another person's expectation of how they see me. Well, guilt, on the other hand, is not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, it does communicate to us that we have done something wrong, and perhaps let's go back and fix the error or ask for forgiveness or whatever. And in this context, guilt also has this potential to be healing and life-giving in relationships. Okay, it can certainly restore. Yet, guilt can also be manipulated by some to coerce others to do what they want them to do. I mean, we might even hear certain phrases like, well, after all I've done for you, or, well, even so and so thinks this about you. And yet, shame and guilt, as well as these other stereotypes and prejudices and sexism, classism, racism, etc., can find no place in the language of the soul. Because once we become firmly rooted in our soul consciousness, any kind of manipulation in the form of shame and guilt no longer affect us. Okay? And in this one example, the more we see ourselves and others as souls, the more we are able to transform and transcend beliefs that no longer serve us. And when this occurs, not only do our relationships take on a healthier tone that transcends time and space, but also we understand the futility of waiting for systems to change. I mean, who said it? Be the change that you want to see in this world? Wisdom indeed. Well, I'm Dr. James Hauck, and you have been listening to Reclaiming Authenticity. Thank you for spending this hour with me, and I invite you to visit the website and leave me your thoughts about tonight's show. Drop me a line, please do. Let me know. Or if there's a topic that you want me to talk about, please, let me know that as well. So in the meantime, everybody be safe out there. Have a great Labor Day weekend and all the more reason to be safe. I mean, let's just be smart about some things and have a good time. And until we talk again, may everybody behave themselves and may you always be held in the palm of God's hands. Take care and God bless.
For an answer, or just to leave 1,000 comments, or prodding to buy a book by Dr. Hauck, it's all there. Just wander on over to reclaimingauthenticity.com and click around. And we'll see you next Friday at noon Pacific time on PBS Radio TV.